At the end of World War II, there were lots and lots of Allied soldiers in prisoner of war camps in Asia. And for reasons that nobody has figured out to this day, about 50 of them from one of the camps got amnesia. So they're mainly European soldiers, and they couldn't remember anything. They couldn't remember their own name, where they were from, who their families were. They didn't know anything about themselves, which was a huge problem. So nobody knew where to send them home to. So there was sort of a tour arranged all through Europe where these 50 men would be taken to stadiums and concert halls across Europe, and people who had lost a loved one could go to these events and they could look at the men. Each of the men would take a moment at the microphone and say a few words. So it was this huge thing all through Europe. People showed up. The first event was at the Paris Opera House. So the place is packed, standing room only. And the 50 men, you know, who are now showered with fresh clothes and a clean shave, were brought up on stage. And the first man stepped to the mic, and he looked out across the audience and made eye contact with as many people as he could. And he said, "Can anyone out there tell me who I am?" And this is the question that all of us are asking every day. Every time we have an interaction, I'm asking that question of you. Every time we talk and we look into each other's eyes, I'm not mainly asking, "Who are you?" I'm asking, who am I? Can you tell me who I am? This idea in psychology is called the looking glass self. So we assemble our sense of ourselves based on feedback from other people. First, it's our mother. And hopefully she's a good mom and she loves us and she cares about us and creates a safe environment for us. And then probably second, it's our father or siblings, you know, and then our immediate family. And then pretty soon it becomes friends and people we work with. And now it's from, you know, maybe people we go to church with. And when we look at each other, we're constantly in some part of our mind asking this question, "Can you tell me who I am?" So identity is a social construct. It's not just a thing where we plop out or come, we're born with a fully constructed sense of self, right? Self identity is a thing that's sort of patched together through a long process over time. And the people in our lives help create it for us. So how we're seen affects how we think we're seen affects how we see ourselves. And this is terrifying and maybe encouraging too. Terrifying because what if we were told a lie all that time? What if we built an identity that just is not true at all? What if we had a mom who maybe for no reason of her own, she was traumatized, she was sad, she was broken because of the weight of baggage in her, or maybe she was absent, that we never got that initial early feedback that told us the truth about who we are? What if we grew up in a family you know, constantly shamed us. And we even though we were you're a good woman or a good man, you grew up with this overwhelming sense of shame. What if, or even worse, maybe even worse, what if your parents only ever affirmed you, even if you acted terribly? They affirmed that too. Like Bruce Springsteen says in his autobiography, "I was king and messiah all rolled into one, and it nearly ruined my life." So, the text that we have to consider today, I think, can help us in this area of identity and how we're putting together an idea of who we are. So let's turn to the text from the Gospel of Mark. Peter declares that Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi, which is on the coast. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." "What about you?" he asked. Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him, which is kind of hilarious to me. I mean, I think a PG paraphrase that I think may be accurate is that Jesus said, "Oh my God, don't tell anybody that." So typically, could you go back one slide to the previous slide? Perfectly. Yeah. Typically when Christians read passages like this, it's super clear cut what this is saying. And you know, this is the assertion, the dominant assertion of Scripture. I mean, this is a series of writings that start with a virgin birth and end with a resurrection. So you kind of see where they're going, right? And in the middle, there's an affirmation out of the mouths of one of Jesus' closest followers, his best right-hand man, of who he is. The Gospels are about the identity of Jesus. And even, you know, when the New International Version, which is New International, was created in the 1970s, you know, some poor schmuck had to go through and make section headings. So they're not in the original Bible. I mean, Mark didn't write. When it says Peter declared that Jesus is the Messiah, that's not Mark. And it's not God. It's an editor, you know, that was employed by the New International Version Committee to go do the work, and then he or she brought their suggestions to the committee, and they were approved or not. And so, obviously, somebody felt like this was what this section of Scripture was saying, which I have no argument with that. Peter declares Jesus is the Messiah. Now, the thing about it is, many times in like Bible study that we were dealing this, we would say, "Well, there it is. Jesus is the Messiah. Believe in him and all will be well, and there's coffee and donuts in the foyer. Good luck with that." And I think there could be even more practical help in this text for us than just the assertion that Jesus is the Messiah, as true as that is to the text. And that is what the text is asserting, for sure. But I think there's even more here. When we say a thing like Jesus is the Messiah, the masses of people treat it as kind of a magic formula. And not saying anything pejorative about the idea that Jesus is the Messiah. Just the masses of people say, then how can I have some of that? You know what I mean? Then how can I have that magic trick working for me? And the Scripture even provides those kind of rituals, like if you believe in your heart that Jesus is the Son of God, and if you declare with your mouth that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. And people say, "Well, sweet, I'm in." Which is good and true and fine, but it's not necessarily helpful in a very gritty, practical, lifelong process like figuring out who we are. See what I mean? So I think that the text is more multi-layered than, more complex than, it gives us some actual help, not just sort of an ontological proclamation about who Jesus is. Let me give you an example. I've tried to think about how, some practical example that may be useful. Now, first, I want to read you one of the scientific nutritional organizations that is online. Says that this is, officially, this is the balanced diet for an average adult. And you should take these nutrients every day. Energy, 8,700 kilojoules. Protein, 50 grams. Fat, 70 grams. Saturated fatty acids, 24 grams. Carbohydrates, 310 grams. Sugars, 90 grams. Sodium, 2.3 grams. Dietary fiber, 30 grams. Do this, and you'll live. eat like this and you'll be healthy. To me, it's kind of an equivalent to Jesus is the Messiah. It's certainly not untrue. It's just kind of out there, like, okay, that's good. But it's a completely different idea to say, start with good bread. Good fresh bread. Good fresh bread recent from the oven. Yeah, like that. Aromatic, lovely, beautiful, rustic fresh bread. And cut two generous slices. Oh yeah. And then take some condiments. Now, this could be to taste, but I like regular mayo, coarse ground mustard, and we're gonna get to the pickles here in a minute, so. And for me, I put this on both sides. I know that's probably not orthodox, but I like it, and I just go for it. So there's that. And this guy, oh, horseradish too, but, oh yeah, I only put this on one side. And then good cheese, you know, don't eat some like processed American cheese, for pity's sake. Eat good cheese, preferably sharp cheddar is what I'm going with today, but it could be any kind of thing. But it has to be good. So there we are. And then I'm going to put another slice on there just to get my 70 grams of fat. Some people say a protein. Some people don't eat meat. You know, other people do. And so for today's illustration, I'm putting the best ham that they had at the deli where I bought it. Best one. Smoked. And then, okay, then we're going to have good pickles. Yep. Yep. And then some veggies. And I'm going to cut off that end so we have some nice flat slices of tomato. And I'm going to double salt this guy. First I'm going to salt the tomato. Then I'm going to put on this fresh red leaf lettuce and salt that too. Oh, can you see that? Now that. That's how to eat. And to me, if we stopped when we said Jesus is the Messiah, then fine, we have a good true thing, you know, like 8,700 kilojoules of energy. But I think if we dig a little deeper in this text, we can get toward this meat and cheese and good bread and condiments that actually can help us figure out what to do. What on earth am I talking about? What in this text is a different, and here's my idea. My idea is, the first way of viewing it is that Jesus is the object of our faith. But the second way I'd like to talk about viewing it is that Jesus is an actual mentor for faith. An actual mentor for our faith journey. So, there is a The way many Christians, kind of the Messiah, you know, only, they just stop with Messiah, would view Jesus is that that he dropped into this earth as a fully formed identity, just like the Terminator dropped into Los Angeles. And because he had, even as a little baby, even as a little child, a fully formed identity, you know, he was a weird kid. You know, he was like God dressed up as a little child. And from that way of thinking, you get texts like this one from the Gospel of Thomas. So let's read this. This little child Jesus, when he was 5 years old, was playing at the ford of a brook, and he gathered together the waters that flowed there into pools, and made them straightway clean, and commanded them by his word alone. And having made soft clay, he fashioned thereof 12 sparrows, and it was the Sabbath when he did these things, or made them. And there were also many other little children playing with him. And a certain Jew, when he saw what Jesus did, playing upon the Sabbath day, departed straightway and told his father Joseph, "Lo, thy child is at the brook, and he hath taken clay and fashioned 12 little birds, and hath polluted the Sabbath day." And Joseph came to the place and saw, and cried out to him, saying, "Wherefore doest thou these things on the Sabbath, which it is not lawful to do?" But Jesus clapped his hands together and cried out to the sparrows and said to them, "Go." And the sparrows took their flight and went away chirping. The reason the Gospel of Thomas is not in the canon for most Christians is because we decided this is not true. We decided, the church did thousands of years ago, that no, Jesus wasn't sure. You know, Jesus wasn't like doing magic tricks as a five-year-old because he was God. That Jesus went through a process of figuring out who he was and what his identity was. Some theologians go so far to say that, you know, Jesus knew nothing of the resurrection until it happened. That he was just as surprised as everybody else. Now, you may or may not believe that, but still, the process of him learning about his identity, I think, was a process over time. And so you could read the Mark text as saying, instead of just being kind of a rhetorical question that Jesus is asking, you know, his followers so that they can affirm, so they can have a learning moment and know who he really is. Maybe at some level in the text, he really wanted to know. Maybe Jesus also looked at Peter and was asking in part of his mind, "Who am I?" Can you imagine how confusing it would be to be Jesus? Growing up with Mary and Joseph and his brothers and sisters. He had sisters, right? Brothers, maybe. His siblings, anyway. And trying to figure out who he was and feeling things. And then having a pretty good sense of what kind of how he thought, who he thought he was. And then being roundly rejected by a lot of people that, like his family, in the end, weren't that crazy about him. They thought he was kind of a pompous guy. And you know, he went back to his hometown to like have a celebrity homecoming, and they just about hanged him because they didn't like him. They thought he was putting on airs. They're telling him things about who he is that were conflicted. And if Jesus was anything, he was religious, and the religious leaders in the center of their religion thought he was a total fraud, wanted rid of him. How confusing and conflicted would this be? So I think maybe Jesus could function as a model and mentor for us in this process of figuring out which voices do I listen to and which voices do I not? And how do I know what's true about myself? Maybe when clearly not everybody's telling me the same thing about myself. So he went through this whole, process, I think. When he went to on a personal retreat in the desert one time, we know he was confused and conflicted and tempted and needed to get his head. This is Jesus we're talking about. If we think Jesus is only Superman come to earth, he's nothing like us. But to me, it helps me to think Jesus struggled through a lot of this stuff. And he didn't know. He had moments of fear. He flinched sometimes. He had moments of doubt. He had people who were not nice to him and people who misunderstood him. And he had to go through that process of dealing with that, processing all of that. In a garden called Gethsemane, he felt alone and sad and afraid. On the cross, he felt abandoned and forsaken. So So what was it that helped Jesus form this positive sense of self? And I think, to me, it's from the story of his baptism, where his father spoke, God the Father spoke to him, and said three things. You are my beloved son, I'm pleased with you. So the first idea is you're a child of... You are a child of a good parent. You know what that means? I mean, and not all of us were children of... All of us were children of imperfect parents. But on another level, with God in the picture, all of us can say, I was the child of a good parent. Which makes a huge difference. A child of a good parent is safe. A child of a good parent is whole, feels whole, and feels secure, and sort of starts her life, his life, with at least that baseline of things are okay. And if we didn't have that at our home, it's not like we're doomed for life. Maybe there's another way to get there, to build that part of our identity that was never maybe shaped in our human family. And that's when God says to us somehow, through some means, you know what? You are my child, and I'm a good parent. And then second, you know, you're loved. And this is, I think, the thing that we need the most. Some psychologists believe that our identity is a factor of those we love and those who love us. And I think that's probably true. You know, that Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. And some people think that identity is all about thinking. You can think your way into it. Maybe. But I think love is better. I think it's probably truer. That the people who loved us in our life, the people that we love in our life, that's kind of what shapes us emotionally. That's how we come to our ultimate identity. And what if we could, even through all of the trauma that all of us have gone through in human relationships, what if at some base level say, I am loved? You know, I think one of the most profound psychological and theological statements is in the form of a song. And the song says, I wish I were an Oscar Mayer Wiener. That is what I'd really like to be. Because if I were an Oscar Mayer Wiener, everyone would be in love with me. That song captures our gaping emotional wounds. It's not the Oscar Mayer Wiener, it's something else. If only I could do this or have this or be this, then I would be loved. And to be loved, to feel like our life has meaning and that people care for us and love us, is by far our most profound need. And most people, they don't go through life saying, I am loved. I don't have to prove myself in order to be loved. I don't have to have made my life a desperate grasping for significance so people will love me. I don't have to wish I were this or I were that or I were Oscar Mayer Wiener. I can rest in this fact that I'm the child of a good parent. And I'm loved right out of the gate, right out the chute, before I do anything, despite misdeeds. And then the third one, I am pleased with you. We need to know that I don't think there's anyone in the world who ever lived who is all bad. You know, God is pleased, not with all of our behaviors all the time, but with us, with our core identity, with who, you know, who we were made to be. God is pleased with us. How would these things shape us? You know what I mean? If we could internalize that we're the child of a good parent, that we are loved, that God is pleased with us. Then it's not like we don't still look at the people around us to help us figure out other aspects of our personality for our whole life. I think that could be good and healthy, but if we don't have that bedrock, then we're either racing after affirmation all the time or running away from you know, what is feels uncomfortable to us, and how can we ever develop a strong sense of self? I think that this example of Jesus can actually help us. We're going to end, I think, with a song. Yeah, please come on up. And, you know, one of the things I thought I would... one of the ways that this text is encouraging to me is that we have the... You know, when people look at us, you know, the immature think, well, they're looking at me. They want to know about me. They want to know. And now mainly they're looking at you because they want to know who they are. And for the mature, this is a great opportunity to help our friends, our family develop a healthy and whole sense of who they are by mirroring back to them that, you know, they're okay, that they're loved. I mean, what an opportunity we have with kids and with people in our life to help them remember who they are. The best, you know, the best things about themselves. So...
bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give his count.